I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. Welcome to Radio Times.
Tonight, round two, Colorado Senator Michael Bennet, former Vice President Joe Biden, South Bend, Indiana Mayor Pete Buttigieg, New York Senator Kirsten Gillibrand, California Senator Kamala Harris, former Colorado Governor John Hickenlooper, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, California Congressman Eric Swalwell, author Marianne Williamson, and former tech executive Andrew Yang.
Last night was the second Democratic presidential debate this week, featuring the other 10 candidates who qualified to stand on the stage. The moderators reminded the candidates about the ground rules that they ignored right out of the gate. There was a fair amount of crosstalk, some pointed and personal arguments, and discussions about health care, immigration, trade, race, and criminal justice, Roe v. Wade, and guns. Joe Biden, the front runner, took the brunt of the attacks about his policies and positions from his many years in government. We will be playing clips from last night's debate. We want you to join the conversation. Who caught your attention? Here's that phone number. It's 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join our conversation. We have three guests who have joined us, including Holly Otterbein, reporter for Politico, a WHYY alumna. She's been covering the Sanders campaign, and she's down at the NPR studios in Washington, D.C. Holly Otterbein, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
It's great to be here.
Also with us and here in our Philadelphia studios is Nyron Crawford. He's assistant professor of political science at Temple University, also a visiting associate research scholar of race and public policy at Princeton University's Woodrow Wilson School. Nyron, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
I should say to our listeners, his very first time on radio. Mark Nevins with us as well. He's a political media and communications expert with the Dover Strategy Group. He also served as Pennsylvania's communications director for Hillary Clinton's 2008 presidential campaign. Mark Nevins, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times as well.
Great to be here.
I hate to start with winners and losers, but it kind of feels like let's start there. And perhaps I'll put this to you first, Mark. Who do you think did well last night?
Well, I think the consensus and the correct consensus is Kamala Harris, Senator Harris from California. I think Mayor Buttigieg did very well in establishing himself. And while I think some people found Congressman Swalwell to be a little repetitive.
Pass the torch, you mean?
Sometimes a repeated message sticks. And I think the takeaway from this a week from now, 2 weeks from now is, well, that's the guy who's the next generation guy. And that's not a bad brand for him if that's what he's trying to establish.
Nyron, who did you see last night that you thought did well?
Sure. So debates are about, they serve an important teaching function. So I think absolutely Kamala Harris had a great night. She was able to establish herself, presented herself as the adult in the room, and had clear policy goals and focuses that she was able to advance in the conversation. I agree that Mayor Pete was able to do well. He had very good answers, well-scripted answers. I think when it came to the question of police brutality, I think he handled it well, maybe too late in this conversation and in front of the wrong audience.
Interesting. And we're going to play some clips from that as well. Let me give you, Holly, a chance to weigh in as well. And let's talk about Bernie Sanders. How do you think he did last night?
I think it was no harm, no foul. You know, it was an okay night for him. I think that his closing statement was strong, hit all those populist notes. There was a moment when he was asked a question about guns by Rachel Maddow where he came off as testy, which he often does with the media and in debates sometimes when he feels challenged. So in the end, it was not a bad night for him. It was not a great night for him. I agree with everyone that Kamala Harris was clearly the winner of the night, much more so even than I think Castro was last night, or the night before, rather. I think what she did was show that she could take on Trump, which is what every Democrat was looking for, by using Joe Biden to basically prosecute the case against a candidate, against a front runner. And she did it extremely well.
In fact, we have that clip. But let's talk about, I guess, perhaps a kind of elephant in the room, Mark, which Joe Biden, how did you, who was the Joe Biden you saw last night?
Well, I don't think it's the Joe Biden he wanted to be, that's for sure. you know, it's not unusual for somebody who's been in office to come back to that first debate and perform poorly. I think President Obama would have loved a do-over in his first debate against Mitt Romney in 2012. Even Ronald Reagan sort of looked out of his depth against Walter Mondale in 1984. So I think it's a little early to say this is it for Joe Biden. But he did play into the sort of negative lane people want to push him into. And that's something he's going to have to overcome quickly.
Curious, Naren, and then I do want to play this clip.
Sure. So I think Mark's absolutely right. And the question, I think, as it relates to Vice President Biden, was what were the expectations for him going in? If we look at his track record in debates over time, he did not perform well against Governor Sarah Palin. So it's not clear to me whether or not the expectations were high or low for him. It is clear that he underperformed considerably during last night's debate. I think if we were to qualify losers and winners, he would have been a clear loser on the debate stage. Now, he may still advance in the nomination process, but if this is any indicator of how he'll perform against the president, who has a sharp tongue on the debate stage, I don't think it bodes well for the vice president.
Let me just quote. This is from Morning Consult in 538 poll. Now, this is before last night's debate. Biden, 32. Warren and Sanders, 18. Harris, 7. Buttigieg, 5. Booker, 4. O'Rourke, 3. Castro, 2. And it goes on from there. So clearly, at least before last night's debate, Joe Biden, the clear winner. Let me play the clip that's been played a lot from last night's debate. And this is Senator Kamala Harris going after Joe Biden on his record regarding busing. And I should say to our listeners, it's about a minute and a half. It's got a slight edit in the middle. We want you to hear this whole thing.
I do not believe you are a racist. And I agree with you when you commit yourself to the importance of finding common ground. But I also believe, and it's personal, and it was hurtful to hear you talk about the reputations of two United States senators who built their reputations and career on the segregation of race in this country. And it was not only that, but you also worked with them to oppose busing. And, you know, there was a little girl in California who was part of the second class to integrate her public schools. And she was bused to school every day. And that little girl was me. Do you agree today that you were wrong to oppose busing in America then?
No,
do you agree?
I did not oppose busing in America. What I opposed is busing ordered by the Department of Education. That's what I opposed.
Well,
I
there
did
was
not
a failure of states to integrate public schools in America. I was part of the second class to integrate Berkeley, California public schools almost two decades after Brown v. Board of Education.
Because your city council made that decision. It was a local decision.
So that's where the federal government must step in. That's why we have the Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights Act. That's why we need to pass the Equality Act. That's why we need to pass the ERA, because there are moments in history where states fail to preserve the civil rights of all people.
I have supported the ERA from the very beginning.
Holly, let me give you a chance to weigh in on that. And she, you know, mixed the personal and the political, I think, in such a riveting kind of way. Your response?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. It was so savvy to start sort of talking about the personal, how she was, you know, someone who was bussed, and then she prosecuted him, right? I mean, this has been the Harris campaign's argument, that this is what she can do. She actually asked him, you know, do you still have the same view on bussing? And Joe Biden, I thought, just looked defensive, which is exactly what he did not want to do. And he took the bait, essentially. He should have just, you know, let her say what she said and then, you know, talked about his record. But he ended up kind of looking like he was, you know, still defending his old position. And that's something, you know, Joe Biden often does not apologize. And in some ways, I think that's been a boon for him. But last night it didn't work out. And I will add, I'll agree with Mark that you know, we don't know whether or not this is actually going to have an impact on the race. I mean, Joe Biden has had a few controversies, you know, where he's made remarks and they get a lot of attention in the news. And then, you know, his polling doesn't change at all. He just still sits right atop the field. A lot of people still aren't paying attention. The news cycle is just so fast nowadays that although this is, you know, something that everyone is focusing on right now, is that, you know, that back and forth that you just played, will it be something that we're talking about tomorrow? I don't know.
Well, Nyren, let me put it to you, and I should say that the two segregationists that he negotiated with, they happened to be Democrats at the time, Eastland and Talmadge. This is also a complicated but important distinction between when the federal government steps in, when there are civil rights violations, and obviously she put this personal story together about her being the recipient of busing, and in a lot of communities, busing was prevented by the states.
Sure. So it's important to point out here that federal intervention was necessary because state and local governments were not willing to engage in the necessary practices to integrate their public schools, right? And so this ends up being a very important moment for both Kamala Harris and Joe Biden, in part because social scientists often debate the consequences of presidential debates. And what's clear is that the soundbite that's going to be played for the next few days is this one. Mm-hmm. And so he's going to have to account for those decisions. And it was an interesting response for him to defend states' rights, which has typically been antithetical to the civil rights movement.
Well, it's so interesting, Mark. I mean, we are in different times, thank goodness, you know, in 2019 than we were back in the 50s, 60s, and even in the 70s. But Joe Biden, he's got baggage. I mean, he's got a voting record that goes back decades.
Sure. And that's one of the biggest challenges of running for president as a senator or as a member of Congress. You take so many votes on so many different things. It's frankly what got John Kerry into so much trouble in 2004. He was for the war before he was against the war. And that's just a symptom of taking all those votes. But there were two things in that exchange that I thought were interesting from a performance perspective.
Sure.
One is that attack by Senator Harris, that was not off the cuff. I mean, that was a planned and executed approach. And from having worked with a lot of candidates and a lot of debates over the years, I can tell you there's a big difference between planning a hit and executing it effectively. And to her credit, not only did she have a good hit to make, but she executed it so effectively so that it came across, as you said, personal,
right,
and emotionally, and that's what really made the difference. And as a candidate for president, that's a terrific feather in her cap because she's somebody now who can make an argument. Similarly, Vice President Biden reacted so much differently than Mayor Buttigieg did. So Mayor Buttigieg got challenged on the police issue in South Bend and owned it and said, there's no diversity, there's a lack of diversity in the police department because I couldn't get it done. And it was honest and direct, and it nipped the whole thing. Well, it didn't nip it in the bud.
No,
but
it still continues.
It continues, but it certainly was a more honest and direct answer in a way that Vice President Biden could not execute. He could not own that.
The contrast.
You know what? Hold on, only because we have to take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. I know Holly wants to add something, and Nyren, it looks like you wanted to do as well. We're talking about last night's debate among the 10 Democrats, the second this week, hosted by NBC, MSNBC, and Telemundo. We want to hear from you. 1-888-477-9499. Much more to talk about after the short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Cohen. Don't even know my name. I'm Marty Moscow-Cohen, and I'm talking with Holly Otterbein. She's a reporter for Politico and has been covering the Sanders campaign. She joins us from the NPR studios in Washington, D.C. Nyren Crawford with us here in our Philadelphia studio, assistant professor of political science at Temple University, visiting associate research scholar of race and public policy at Princeton's Woodrow Wilson School. Also with us, Mark Nevins. He's a political media and communications expert with the Dover Strategy Group. And we've been talking about last night's debate, specifically talking about this back and forth between Kamala Harris and Joe Biden. And I know, Nyren, you wanted to add something, and so did you, Holly. Nyren, go ahead, and then Holly, I'll get
you
in.
Sure. So I just wanted to add something to Mark's point. I think Senator Harris's hit was very strategic and it landed. And I think that was a very valuable moment in the debate. I think another thing to be mindful of is the extent to which it rattled the vice president. And he was visibly angry at the end of his response because of the challenge that Senator Harris had posed to him.
And I read some commentary saying, and I think you mentioned this earlier too, Mark, which is if the goal of whoever wins the Democratic primary is to challenge Donald Trump, is it Joe Biden or is it Kamala Harris? I realize that, you know, this is one day in 2019.
Yeah, so one of the things that I've been thinking about as relates to Senator Harris is her prosecutorial background. And she made a very interesting point that I think is underappreciated, and I think we'll get to it later. She said, we need to a nominee who has the ability to prosecute the case against former years of Donald Trump, and I will do that. I think given the circumstances with the Mueller report and other questions about emoluments, I think that's a skill set and an experience that will be valuable to the nominee.
Holly, you wanted to add something. Go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to add to Mark's point. I thought that Pete's response when he was asked about the recent police shooting in South Bend, his community, was probably the second most, you know, notable moment of the night. And when it happened, I thought, wow, that's a real risk that he's taking. You know, it's an interesting response, but by claiming responsibility, it's risky, especially as he's struggled with African-American voters. But I thought it looked better after the Joe Biden-Kamala Harris exchange. And so there was a, you know, comparison there for viewers, which is that you had Joe Biden on one hand very defensive about his record and you know, what's his mistakes. And then Pete Buttigieg was taking responsibility. So I think that actually really worked out for Pete.
Well, let's play that clip. And just to set it up, of course, he's the mayor of South Bend, Indiana. He had to leave the trail this week to deal with a crisis at home. A white police officer shot a black man, killed him. Very angry, upset residents of South Bend. I should say that the police force at South Bend is 6% black in a city of 25% African Americans. And he was challenged. And here's what Pete Buttigieg said.
My community is in anguish right now because of an officer-involved shooting, a black man, Eric Logan, killed by a white officer. And I'm not allowed to take sides until the investigation comes back. The officer said he was attacked with a knife, but he didn't have his body camera on. It's a mess, and we're hurting. And I could walk you through all of the things that we have done as a community, all of the steps that we took from bias training to de-escalation, but it didn't save the life of Eric Logan. And when I look into his mother's eyes, I have to face the fact that nothing that I say will bring him back. This is an issue that is facing our community and so many communities around the country. And until we move policing out from the shadow of systemic racism, whatever this particular incident teaches us, we will be left with the bigger problem of the fact that there's a wall of mistrust put up one racist act at a time, not just from what's happened in the past, but from what's happening around the country in the present. It threatens the well-being of every community. And I am determined to bring about a day when a white person driving a vehicle and a black person driving a vehicle, when they see a police officer approaching, feels the exact same thing, a feeling not of fear, but of safety. I am determined to bring that day about.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
So, Mark, critique that or give us your response.
Well, it was honest and genuine. And I think in this day and age, voters in particular, especially primary voters, have a pretty sensitive alarm button for BS. And they can tell when a candidate is just saying something they don't really believe. That came across as authentic and genuine and believable and personal.
Well, and I mean, I think it should be said the important role that black voters play in the Democratic Party in particular, black women in particular,
Sure.
So for Pete Buttigieg and I think for others on the stage, that has to be front and center on their minds.
Absolutely. I think he gave a very good answer until and except when Congressman Swalwell asked him why he didn't fire the police officer.
Which I thought was interesting,
right.
Yes.
And so at that moment, he was unable to account for why he did not take that policy action. And it may be bound by Indiana law, but he wasn't able. But he was also visibly frustrated by the interjection of the congressman in asking that question. So while I think the answer was good and well-designed and delivered, I think the ending may have compromised it altogether.
Let me read two comments, and then we'll take Brian from Middletown, Delaware. They're all about Kamala Harris. Dan says, I don't think that Kamala did as well. The Democratic Party shouldn't become a party of identity politics. An email from Beverly, I had a different reaction to Kamala Harris than your guests. Although I thought she began her challenge to Biden effectively, she appeared to become so very angry that it calls into question how she would deal with other leaders as president. Keep that in mind, and let's get Brian from Middletown, Delaware, to join our conversation. Hi, Brian. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Good morning, Marty. Big fan of your show.
Thank you.
And it's certainly a great topic. First, I'll make a quick comment. That person who sent that message about identity politics, how ironic. There's a man in the White House who got there based upon identity politics. So, you know, I'm a 52-year-old African-American male. I'm a card-carrying Democrat. And I've made the case to my friends here whether they attempt to impeach Donald Trump or not. They can hold impeachment hearings until November 2020. I'm casting my vote for the Democratic nominee. And I know for many people who are part of my circle, they feel the same way. But that's it. Regarding the debate, Kate, very impressed with Kamala Harris. My wife actually lived through busing. She was adult. She grew up in Delaware, so we know all about that dynamic. And I mentioned to your producer, I actually had supported Beto O'Rourke, meaning I contributed to his campaign, also contributed to Harris as well. But, you know, part of what I wanted to see was, you know, a grasp of the issues, but also like the energy. And as much as I support Biden, I'm a Delawarean, I'm really worried about seeing him on stage with Trump. I just don't think he has the energy, the tenacity to really go after Trump the way that Kamala Harris does. And one last thing I'll leave you with.
Sure.
I think the only concern regarding Kamala was based upon how people voted in 2016. Like, will people actually not vote for a woman who's clearly more qualified than the guy who's in office? So that would be my only concern. But again, I'm voting for whoever the nominee will be. Have a great day.
You too, Brian. I should say, I grew up in Middletown, Delaware as well, so I know about some of those racial politics. This was back in the 50s and the 60s. Let me give you a chance, Mark, to weigh in on that as well. I mean, we have more than one female candidate. We had several last night and several the night before. Does that change the dynamic?
I'm not sure it does. I think... if anything, from 2016, you know, one of the takeaways was just how significant the challenge is for women running for office. They are held to a different standard, and they have to be both tenacious and assertive and be heard, and yet they are held to this second set of rules unfairly. That they can't be too tenacious and they can't be too mean. And you would see people like the email you got that said, oh, I think she might have been too mean or too angry. I did not personally get that impression, but that exists.
Holly, you want to weigh in on that?
Yeah. I mean, you see this on the trail a lot. I've been to some of the early states like Iowa and South Carolina. And something that comes up from Democratic voters themselves is that they want to vote for a woman, but they are afraid because of what happened in 2016 about voting for a woman. And so I think that they are going to be looking for proof that they, you know, that the women candidates, including somebody like Kamala Harris, can deliver on stage and you know, can show that they can beat Trump. But it's a higher standard that they're being held to, definitely, probably even higher than in 2016, because a lot of Democrats, you know, feel scarred from that experience.
And Niren, she's a woman of color, just sure. To sort of add to the complexity here, right?
Yeah, and so I would say that all the female candidates in this race are twice as good than their male counterparts and certainly do struggle with the double expectation gap. But on the point about identity politics is threaded through American life. And so with the reemergence of white nationalism and other anti-Black or anti-Latinx biases, it's hard to have a conversation and say this is not in some ways about identity. It very much is.
Here's a tweet from Roxana. She says, I think Pete Buttigieg handled the question about the recent tragedy in South Bend very well, but it begs the question of why he is running for president when he has problems he hasn't been able to solve in his own city. You're nodding your head, Niren.
Yeah, so...
And we should also say there are votes happening in Congress, and all these Congress people and senators are not there to vote.
Sure. So I think if you're a mayor and you want to be held accountable and you want to give a good faith effort in trying to deal with racial challenges in your community, I think you say something like, I wasn't able to get it done to the residents of your community. You do not say it on a national debate stage for the office of President of the United States.
Go ahead, Holly.
Yeah, I think he handled it as best as he could, but that was also the first time that millions of Americans probably heard about that controversy, right? He handled it as best as he could, but it still could be harmful to him.
Here's an email from Rosemary. She says, my fear is the Democrats are going to spend too much time tearing each other down and hand this to the president and his party, giving them all the fodder they need to defeat the eventual candidate. I mean, Mark, this is what happens in primaries, right? I mean,
sure.
You're fighting to be the nominee.
You know, these primaries are job interviews, right? So you've got 24 however many we're at now, it could be 25 by the end of the show. I don't know.
Because didn't Joe Sisek just toss his name in?
Yeah. So you've got 20, let's just call it two dozen or so candidates interviewing for the same job. And it's fair to ask tough questions. It's fair for them to ask each other tough questions. The expensive, destructive primary concern cuts both ways. On the one hand, people are right. You have to spend a lot of your money on the primary, and a candidate could come out severely damaged out of the primary. On the other hand, the Democrats will dominate the conversation in the American voting public probably through this time next year, at least, if not longer, which means that they're sucking up all the oxygen and all those conversations, and that's less time even for this president to try and get himself or inject himself into the conversation. Clearly, despite the very nasty Republican primary in 2016, it didn't keep Donald Trump from getting elected. So that's a double-edged sword. It can go both ways.
I mean, there wasn't name-calling. There was just a big argument last night about several important issues. Let me just quickly reintroduce everybody. Talking with Mark Nevins, political media and communications expert with the Dover Strategy Group. Nyron Crawford, assistant professor of political science at Temple University, also affiliated with Princeton's Woodrow Wilson School. And Holly Otterbein, she's a reporter for Politico, has been on the campaign trail, largely following the Sanders campaign, and we're talking about last night's debate, what happened, what it means. You can call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join the conversation. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Let me just throw out some other things, and I think this happens during a primary. I guess the conventional wisdom is that the Democrats kind of go left, the Republicans go right to get their base, and then somehow meet in the middle in the general campaign. And I think it is interesting, and Holly, I'll put this to you about, in many ways, how Bernie has moved the Democratic Party to the left. I've said this before, he's not a Democrat, but nonetheless, we'll kind of let that just hang out there. But immigration came up, healthcare came up, some other issues that are really hot button issues came up. And while I can see a lot of the base really being excited about what the candidates said or when they raised their hands, I wonder if that's problems in the general election.
So one of the questions that came up both last night and the night prior was, will you abolish private health insurance in favor of a, you know, Medicare for all government run health care program? And you had, you know, candidates, including Bernie Sanders, Kamala Harris, Elizabeth Warren and Bill de Blasio raise their hands. When you look at polling right now, Medicare for all is very popular, particularly among Democrats, but even the general elected, it's pretty popular. But when you actually drill down and tell people that it means that private insurance will be abolished, then it ends up being a politically risky proposal. So for those candidates, they do have work to do. If they get to the general election, you know, they are going to have to do the work of persuading people that this is the right way to go. What progressives say is that, you know, they had a more traditional Democratic candidate last time around and it didn't get the job done. And certainly, you know, politics are just changing all across the country and really the world. And there's been this kind of rise of populism. And so, you know, in the eyes of progressives, at least, they argue that, you know, the old way of doing things just has not worked, and it's time to try a kind of bolder, more populist, strategy, and that actually will win over the voters. We have yet to see whether or not that's true.
Sure. And Mark, when you read about what the public is interested in on the top of the list is something to do with healthcare.
Right. And, you know, it was interesting to me because I think already this morning, Senator Harris has walked back that position.
If I read correctly this morning,
that she said that she may have misunderstood the question. And it was an oddly worded question, not to get into the weeds on that, but the way it was phrased was, would you abolish your own private health care in favor of a government-run health care?
Meaning your personal health care, right?
That was my interpretation of the question, is would you give up your private health care for the government health care option? And I think I was surprised in Wednesday's debate when not more people raised their hand, because I thought, okay, you wouldn't give up your... And then it turned out the point of the question was, would you abolish all private health care, which was not the way the question was asked. So in fairness to Senator Harris, I can see where there may have been a little confusion. Having said that, that is an extreme position and one that will be hard to sell to voters in a general election. And it goes to that larger point you're making, which is, how do you eventually move yourself back to the middle to appeal to those independent and undecided voters in a general election? And if you move yourself too far to one side, it's hard to do.
Naren, do you want to add to that?
Sure. So I think in general, progressives complain about moderate Democrats. And so I think two things have happened. I think Bernie Sanders has been able to push the party to the left, and I think in very important ways. And second, I think President Trump has had a radicalizing effect on voters in many ways. And so they see an election in 2016 and say, well, we've got to do something different. And so maybe these bold plans are necessary. So Kamala Harris said something last night, which has been echoed elsewhere, about how we pay for these things, and asking, well, we don't ask how we pay for anything else except things that would improve Americans' lives.
Very interesting. We're going to play Bernie Sanders' clip after this very short break, and we are talking about last night's debate, the second debate this week among Democrats running for president. They weren't all there, but there were a lot of them, 10 last night and 10 the night before. And talking with Holly Otterbein, Naren Crawford, and Mark Nevins. We're going to take a very short break and carry on this conversation. As I mentioned, we'll have Senator Bernie Sanders talking about how he would pay for his Medicare for All proposal. Stay with us. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen. And if you're just joining us, we're talking about last night's debate, the Democrats running for the presidential nomination, obviously taking on President Trump in the general election. Talking with Mark Nevins, he's a political media and communications expert with the Dover Strategy Group. I should add, he served as Pennsylvania's communications director for Hillary Clinton's 2008 presidential campaign. Naren Crawford is an assistant professor of political science at Temple University, visiting associate research scholar of race and public policy at Princeton's Woodrow Wilson School. And they're with us here in our Philadelphia studios and down at the NPR studios in Washington, D.C., Holly Otterbein, reporter for Politico. You can join us, 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me play a clip from last night. This is Senator Bernie Sanders. He is answering a question about how he will pay for his Medicare for All proposal.
We have a new vision for America. And at a time when we have three people in this country owning more wealth than the bottom half of America, while 500,000 people are sleeping out on the streets today, we think it is time for change, real change. And by that, I mean that health care, in my view, is a human right. And we have got to pass a Medicare for All single-payer system. Under that system, by the way, vast majority of the people in this country will be paying significantly less for health care than they are right now.
Senator Sanders, I'll give you 10 seconds just to answer the very direct question. Will you raise taxes for the middle class in a Sanders administration?
People who have health care under Medicare for All will have no premiums, no deductibles, no co-payments, no out-of-pocket expenses. Yes, they will pay more in taxes, but less in health care for what they get.
Thank you, Senator.
Holly, you're covering Senator Sanders. He is, if anything, he is consistent. I mean, this is the Bernie Sanders we remember from several years ago.
Yeah. I mean, obviously what he said about, you know, raising taxes, people will say that that could be used against him. And that's certainly true. He has said it many times before, though, as you said, he's very consistent. I thought that, you know, that answer was not a flub, but it was not his strongest moment either. Usually, supporters of Medicare for All and the Sanders campaign really try to stress that on the whole, middle-class Americans will pay less. So they'll pay more in taxes, but less in health care, and they'll end up actually saving money once all is said and done. And he didn't really hit that. He kind of suggested it, but it just wasn't really that clear.
Well, Mark, it is interesting that, I mean, the influence that Bernie Sanders has had on the Democratic Party. I mean, I think it's pretty extraordinary.
Well, he certainly pushed the conversation further to the left, starting in 2016 and continuing. I'm not sure he stopped running for president from 2016 into 2019 into 2020. But I'm not sure how much credit you get for setting the terms of the debate at this point. He's competing for space in that lane with Senator Warren, to some extent with Senator Harris, with all of the sort of progressive candidates who want to own that progressive lane. Heck, even Mayor de Blasio wants to be in that lane. Yeah. And now it's a little harder in 2020, in this 2020 cycle, to define yourself in the context of dozens of candidates versus running against somebody like Hillary Clinton in 2016 when it was one-on-one and he was the rabble-rouser and she was the establishment candidate. The roles were very clearly defined, and now I think he's finding it harder to find a lane that's his lane, clearly.
Nyrin.
I think that's especially true in view of Elizabeth Warren. She actually gave the better answer on Medicare for All on Wednesday night. So she starts with saying, I spent a chunk of my life studying why families go broke. And one of the number one reasons is the cost of health care. And I think that's relatable to the voting public.
Well, Holly, I'll toss this to you. I mean, Bernie doesn't get real personal. I mean, that's my and that. He's a wonky, policy politics guy, not particularly personal.
He is not. And his campaign has tried to push him to talk more about his personal life, to talk about the fact that he's, you know, the son of an immigrant, that his family members died in the Holocaust. He has actually a really strong personal story, but he just does not like to tell it. And he's told it a little teeny tiny bit more on the campaign trail this time around, but not as much as his advisors want him to. I will add on Warren, I thought it was super interesting that when she was on the debate stage the other night and was asked about Medicare for All, that she raised her hand shot right up when she was asked the question about abolishing private insurance and said, clearly, I'm with Bernie on this. That was new. Mm-hmm. She previously, when asked about Medicare for All, although she is a co-sponsor of Bernie's plan, she said she's open to other ideas, kind of left it unclear in the minds of a lot of progressive activists whether or not she was really committed to the idea. And so I thought that her answer was a signal to the party's activist base that she was with them. And it was also a welcome sign to Bernie Sanders supporters that, hey, you can come with me. You can trust me.
I also thought it was interesting that Kirsten Gillibrand last night, Mark, also said, I'm with Bernie. I mean, essentially, she seemed to embrace a lot of his policies.
Right, which is part of the challenge for Bernie right now, which is all these people jumping on his bandwagon, which is terrific. Except that it doesn't always turn into votes. People don't say, oh, well, everybody likes Bernie's plan, so I'm going to just be with Bernie because he's the original. Yeah. You know, Apple invents the iPhone, but then Samsung comes along and people want to buy those too. So it's hard to occupy the lane by yourself.
Yeah,
I'll add the strategy. The strategy that the Bernie Sanders campaign, you know, says that they have is that they believe that voters basically don't trust politicians you know, to get things done that they say that they want to get done, and to, you know, support the ideas that they say they support. And so they think that by showing that he's kind of the original, and that he's been dedicated to these ideas for decades, even though, even when they were very unpopular, means that, like, he'll actually stick to it once he's in the White House. So the question is, are voters actually, you know, that angry at politicians? Certainly, chunk of them are, but, you know, is it enough to win the primary?
Interesting. Niren, you want to add something? Then we'll play a clip from Kirsten Gillibrand.
Yeah, so I think it's interesting what Senator Sanders, as it relates to whether or not he identifies as a Democrat. So after running in 2016, he returned to the Senate and said, I am an independent. So to have other Democrats seizing on policy ideas and joining in his causes and actually identifying as a Democrat, I think works in their favor more so for than him.
Is it a weird that you've got then a self-described independent or self-described socialist Democrat running as a Democrat? I maybe I'm really dumb here, Mark.
I'm not sure, but I'm just not sure voters pay that much attention to the party label because the words coming out of his mouth sound like a Democrat.
Let me play Senator Kirsten Gillibrand, and she did a lot of interrupting last night, we should say, but she also made a strong case for women's issues, and this is a clip on Roe v. Wade.
Women's reproductive rights are under assault by President Trump and the Republican Party. 30 states are trying to overturn Roe v. Wade right now. And it is mind-boggling to me that we are debating this on this stage in 2019 among Democrats, whether women should have access to reproductive rights. I think we have to stop playing defense and start playing offense.
Niren, how important do you think this issue is?
I think it's very important. I think concerns in Alabama and Missouri and other states raise serious questions about the health of women and their health care choices. And so I think what's going on in these states is of serious concern. What I liked about what she said is that she was calling on women and the men who love them to think about this issue and take it seriously. And I think that was an important call for action.
It should be said, Mark, that people who oppose abortion, and many of them are Republicans, have made incredible inroads on the state level. I mean, we see what's happening in states across the country where people are being essentially denied the right to an abortion.
Sure. And I think that stems from a change in the makeup of the Supreme Court. There's more sort of courage on the far pro-life side to introduce new legislation that will likely get challenged and bumped up to the Supreme Court and perhaps serve as the basis for overturning Roe v. Wade. You know, politically, strategically, in a Democratic primary, there tend to be more women voting than men in any given state across the board. So for somebody like Senator Gillibrand or Senator Warren or any of the women on the stage to try and own the reproductive rights leader lane and try and make that part of their campaign message, their brand, is strategically savvy because they can try and take advantage of that gender gap.
Holly, how do you see that?
When you look at polls, I mean, Democrats obviously are very supportive of pro-choice policies, but they don't usually rank them as like the number one or number two thing that they're voting on. And so I wonder if that's part of the reason that Gillibrand is struggling in the polls right now. Her favorability ratings are fine, but maybe you know, this is just not the issue that Democrats are valuing the most. We'll see. There's a lot of time left in the race.
Indeed, there is, and there's another debate not so far away. Well, we want to hear from you about last night's debate, or perhaps some of the candidates who interest you, perhaps those who have turned you off. You can call us 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. A comment from Kate. She says, we need to think a little more about what the president's job description is when voting. We shouldn't be choosing a president based on who we'd have a beer with. And that's this whole, Mark, this whole sort of comfort level that criteria that people have.
Sure. And the challenge of that is that you want somebody who's relatable, somebody you feel like you could sit down and have a beer with. And yet at the same time, you kind of want somebody who's not just like you, because most people feel probably like they're not qualified to be president. So if it's your next door neighbor, you think, well, that guy's not
with
qualified to be president.
With some exceptions, I should say there.
Right. So I do think it's a double-edged sword. But, you know, there is a relatability factor. You want somebody you feel comfortable with when you go into that voting booth. If you're undecided, and a lot of people do walk in not quite knowing who they're going to go with, there's a level of comfort that they feel with somebody that forces them or causes them to pick that person. And that's, you know, it's a fair thing to say, let's not use the would you have a beer with that person criteria, but at the root of it, that can be a tipping point.
A Facebook comment from Carol. She says, we need a nominee who can win. Harris was aggressive in attacking Biden's record, but he is a respected statesman who can beat Trump. It's interesting where, and perhaps because we're being heard in Delaware, Niren, that there is this sort of Kamala Harris, Joe Biden back and forth. Sure. And perhaps from last night, from that sort of riveting moment.
I think part of it is the reflection that Joe Biden is a statesman, and one would expect that he would excel in a way that he did not last night. And Kamala Harris came out as the obvious winner. So I think because Vice President Biden is still leading in the polls, people want to reconcile how someone else was able to do so well. I do also think there's a race and gender dynamic that one has to account for.
Absolutely. And again, you are listening to Radio Times. I'm Marty Moscoen. You're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. We have a tweet from Barry. It's unacceptable that reparations did not get any time in both conversations, although it should be said, Holly, that Marianne Williamson talked about reparations. Does it surprise you that that wasn't part of either night's discussion?
Yeah, I mean, a little bit. It was definitely one of the more hot-button issues that some of the candidates have embraced. I'm surprised we haven't talked about Marianne Williamson yet, though.
I was waiting to the end, you know, the big buildup.
Yeah, I mean, wow.
Wow.
She is an interesting candidate. We knew that it was going to be interesting, and indeed she
Love
delivered.
Will fix us all, right?
Yeah. You know, Andrew Yang was also supposed to be kind of the wild card interesting candidate, but his tweets are much more out there than he was on the stump. I thought he actually was kind of boring, which has to be a letdown to some of his very dedicated supporters.
Yeah, and the universal basic income. Interestingly, Niren, Mueller didn't come up, impeachment didn't come up. I don't know if that was, they weren't asked about it, but none of the candidates took an opportunity to say that. Did that surprise you?
So it came up briefly, and again, it was with Senator Harris. It did surprise me because I think that is something that is top of mind for at least a lot of journalists, if not for the voting public. It is something that's coming our way on July 17th when the special counsel testifies before the House and Senate. But at the same time, this is the first debate. So candidates have to establish themselves, especially the lesser-known candidates. The first debate is incredibly important for that. And the conversation can't be about impeaching the president. I don't think that gets a lot of traction on the first night.
Mark, do debates matter?
You know,
especially this early in the campaign?
They used to matter a lot more, right? Because there were a limited number of places where you could get information about candidates. Over time, I think they only matter to the extent that there is a flub or a gaffe or a mistake, right? The moments you remember from debates tend to be the mistakes, right? Rick Perry saying not being able to remember the three departments
oops.
He went and cut, and then just saying oops. You know, those are the moments that sort of stick out to you. And now with information available on Twitter, on Facebook, you know, online, it's through so many different avenues. The debates are sort of less important for decision making, and I believe to some extent that people watching debates probably already have some of their minds made up.
Interesting. Well, we have to end our conversation there. My thanks to all three of you for joining us today on Radio Times. Holly Otterbein, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. And she joined us from the NPR studios in Washington, D.C., and she is a reporter for Politico, and she used to work here at WHYY. Niren Crawford, thank you for coming in as well.
Thank you so much for having me.
And he's affiliated with both Temple University and also Princeton University. And Mark Nevins, thanks for coming in.
Thanks again.
And he's a Democratic strategist. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times to find out more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show. Find us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter. Al Banks, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. Xavier Lopez on phones and social media today. The show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us.